Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. Welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Phoenix is hosting the WNBA All-Star Game as the league's popularity is sky high and creating escapism by requiring people to escape. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
It is terrible. We have to come together and we have to stop inflaming this kind of rhetoric, using this kind of rhetoric. People have to not look to violence to solve their political disagreement.
I've gone through and I've been making my own calls to Secret Service agents that I know that are willing to talk to me off the record. And there's a lot of severe problems.
The acceptance of this kind of violence and dehumanizing rhetoric has morphed into a demand or an expectation that this rhetoric occur.
I, Shelby Bush, the delegation chair, and our wonderful state chairwoman, Gina Swoboda, and this entire delegation cast their 43 delegates to Donald J. Trump!
We are losing a generation of young people to this fentanyl crisis, and it's got to stop. The Grand Canyon State has become the fentanyl state, and it's not okay with this, Mom. I'm not okay with that.
It's clear that they all have a bias, and it's also clear that at least all the Republicans on the committee, which was a majority, are supporting a ballot initiative that is completely contrary to ours. And so we think it is intentional.
And with me to talk about Arizona's representation at the Republican National Convention, one Arizonan being floated as a potential replacement on the Democratic ticket and more, are Marcus Delartino of First Strategic. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And former state lawmaker Reginald Bolting. Reginald, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Marcus, do you see the president's speech last night?
Yes, I did.
What do you think?
I thought it was long.
90 minutes, right?
It was over 90 minutes, covered probably everything under the sun. I think what was most, and this is complete sort of insider stuff, but the speech that was written that's on the teleprompter I thought was a pretty good speech. But his tell is so obvious when he goes off script because you can see him clearly reading the teleprompter and then pivot right to the center of the stage and look out straight in front. And that's when he starts to go off script. And I think that that's largely what made it an hour and a half long speech rather than probably an hour.
Is the Republican Party as unified right now as it looked like it was on TV?
I would say it is definitely more unified than it was 4 years ago. There is absolutely no doubt about it. And we heard a lot about unity. I think Nikki Haley's speech went a far way in sort of establishing that unity point. So all in all, I think it was a pretty successful convention. But I do point out to people, if you need any further evidence of how different this party is from your parents, Ronald Reagan Republican Party, let's just hit a few high notes here. We had the head of the world's largest union as a speaker at a Republican National Convention. A professional retired wrestler, Hulk Hogan, and an adult film star. And so this is not your parents' Ronald Reagan Republican Party anymore.
Reginald, at the Democratic Convention, will anybody be ripping their shirts off on stage, do you think?
I don't think
like
so.
Like Hulk Hogan does.
I don't think so.
So, I mean, obviously, as Marcus said, like this party is far more unified now than it was 4 years ago. At the same time, the Democratic Party seems pretty – I don't know, is it disunified, ununified, whatever the word is? The Democratic Party is not necessarily all on the same page at this moment.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that the Republican Party, everything is roses and flowers. I mean, if you watch the Trump speech, which I know a lot of people started it. I don't know how many people finished it because it was very long. I mean, if I'm summing it up, I would say, it was long. It was boring. I thought it was supposed to be unifying. It started to lead more into typical Trump, more the divisiveness that we have come to be used to. I think in the Democratic Party right now, I mean, I remind people, if you think about July of 2020, You know, you had all of these individuals in the Democratic Party who were running for office, from Bloomberg to Harris to Sanders to Warren. You had all of these folks. So the Democratic Party, they, you know, you never had everyone all lined up behind Biden. But I do think at the end of the day, you know, this will get sorted out. And I think Trump actually didn't make a great case for himself. He reminded people of why they retired him in 2020.
Do you think that Carrie Lake, we heard a little clip of her at the top there. Do you think she made the case that she needed to make? She had a huge audience there.
Yeah, Carrie Lake, I really think she gained zero voters, new voters based on that speech. I mean, look, she has consistently over and over again been given opportunities to show that she's grown from the Carrie Lake that defined herself during the 2022 election. But time and time again, she continues to go back into this lane in which she's just, you know, divisive. In Arizona, to be a United States Senator from Arizona, you have to be able to work with everybody. And she has not shown that she has the ability to do that.
Yeah, I'm curious, Marcus, what you made of her speech. And then afterwards, she had a couple of television interviews, which I think could maybe kindly be called contentious.
Yeah, I think I would. That's a good descriptor. I don't think you gain Arizona voters by doing a speech at 4 o'clock on for the RNC convention, because really what you know, your target audience is an independent voter, right? Or maybe a moderate or a less general, a less primary voter, a general election voter. And so those people aren't going to be watching the speech. There's no doubt about it. But it does appeal to a national audience.
Which helps with fundraising, in theory, right?
Yeah. And so really at the end of the day, the goal wasn't necessarily to pick up voters in Arizona as much as it was to pick up the fundraising base.
Are you surprised that she stuck to a lot of the talking points that she has been using? I mean, we talked about former President Trump maybe trying to be a little more unifying. Carrie Lake talked about the media and talked about, you know, how horrible Democrats are. Like a lot of the stuff that she's been talking about.
Yeah, the red meat issues. I mean, I didn't hear anything that I haven't heard her say before, you know, especially the mama bear speech. But again, it's about the fundraising. And so that appeals to that fundraising base, not necessarily to the independent voter in Arizona.
So, Reginald, if you are Ruben Gallego and his campaign, what do you take from what you heard her say at the RNC?
You take every single clip every single clip throughout the speech. I mean, you know, what she's saying essentially is not what Arizonans want to hear. I mean, she's not talking about ways that she's going to improve the economy. She's not talking about ways that she's going to bring people together. When we think about the environment that we're in politically and the rhetoric that has been turned up, you know, consistently, you know, she's one of those individuals who has consistently been part of that using that language. And I think if you're Ruben Gallego, you just continue to point out the Carrie Lake that you knew in 2022 is the same Carrie Lake in 2024. She hasn't changed, and she's not going to be good for Arizona as a brand.
What do you make of the fact, Reginald, that, and, you know, we try not to get too much into, you know, individual polls, but we've seen over the course of several polls now over the last month or let's say 6 weeks, that Democratic Senate candidates, in some cases incumbents, in a number of swing states are polling pretty far ahead, at least ahead, in some cases more than a little bit ahead of President Biden, including Ruben Gallego here. We've Senator Bob Casey in Pennsylvania, Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, and some others. The Democratic senators and Senate candidates are doing better in the polls than the very top of the ticket.
Yeah, I mean, starting at the top of the ticket, I really think, you know, President Trump, in football terms, he was on the 10-yard line to run into a touchdown. He could have selected a VP candidate that was a moderate, and I think his chances to win the election would have greatly improved. He ultimately chose someone in J.D. Vance who may be a little bit further right than him with his stance on the national abortion ban. His speech, again, was it could have been unifying. It was divisive. I really think he fumbled, and he's now allowing for those people who are Biden underperforming folks, you know, Trump's not, you know, when you look at all of these polls, Trump's not over 51%. It's just Democrats are underperforming. So, you know, here in Arizona, you see Ruben Gallego, his numbers are greatly higher than Biden. It's because there's Democrats who aren't committing to Biden right now. I do think those Democrats will come along. But I think independents. I think those Democrats are going to come along definitely for Biden. I think they'll come along
for
Biden.
You think Biden's going to be on the ticket in November?
I totally believe that at the end of the day that the message and the policies that are coming from the Democratic platform, it fits mainline what Arizonans want, no matter who that person is.
Well, so, I mean, that is the big question, right, for Democrats. I mean, we keep hearing over the last couple of days, pressure is building. President Trump is reflective while he's at home in Delaware, isolating with COVID. Do you, at the end of the day, I mean, none of us has a crystal ball, of course. Do you think at the end of the day that Joe Biden is the nominee?
Joe Biden says he says he's running. He says that he's going to be there. I mean, if we spend more time looking at the policies and things that he's done and things that he wants to do instead of trying to figure out whether or not he's going to run, I think the Democratic Party would be in a better position right now. I mentioned this a couple weeks ago. You know, there's literally, 250 some odd Democrats in Congress. You have 15 or 16 calling for him to drop out. Just today, you have the Speaker, you have the Senate, the House Minority Leader, and Hakeem Jeffries saying, "Hey, I'm a Biden Harris ticket." So, I think that until he says he's not doing it, we should assume that he's doing it.
Do you assume he's doing it?
Oh, he's dropping out Sunday.
That's very specific,
weekend.
Marcus.
Listen, Chuck Schumer's talked to him. Nancy Pelosi's talked to him. Barack Obama finally broke. I predicted this all a year ago, so it's just happening. You know, these couple days are happening fast, but this has been going on for a solid year in D.C., talking about who's going to be the replacement. There's an all-hands meeting with his campaign staff today. I assume that conversation's going to be something like, hey, you get another 30 days of pay, and then we're folding up shop. But I expect a massive announcement coming out of Joe Biden, that the Democratic National Convention is going to be an open floor fight. And, man, that's going to be fun to watch.
Fun to watch, like, as a country or as a Republican?
As a Republican.
I just want to clear that up.
It'll be historic, though. So from a country standpoint, I mean, it will be a history-making episode. And, you know, to the Lake point, what I would caution my Democrat friends about is that, you know, Trump enthusiasm, there is an enthusiasm gap with Biden versus Trump. There's no doubt about it. It's undeniable. Trump's up in every swing state. And what for Republicans, he's carrying that energy, that turnout model into these states, which will propel Republicans into office. So for those who are quick to say, you know, Ruben Gallego's got this locked up, I think this race is going to be a whole heck of a lot closer than people think it is.
Is there a candidate out there, before you even get into that, let's say President Biden is not the Democratic nominee, without knowing who might the nominee be, does that change any of the polling? Does that change potentially the result in Arizona?
Yeah, I think it does. It changes a whole lot of things. To Reggie's point about J.D. Vance, I mean, the genius about a J.D. Vance is he comes out of Ohio and you're watching this meltdown in these Midwestern states where Democrats – traditionally a Democrat-leaning state is going with Trump. And so, you know, Democrats have to figure out how to stop that bleed in these northeastern states. As far as Arizona goes, I mean, what happens if – let's just do an if – you know, the ticket is Gretchen Whitmer
Mark Kelly.
Sorry.
Okay.
Wow.
It sounds like.
Didn't have enough coffee this morning. But Mark Kelly from Arizona. Would that turnout change for Democrats in Arizona? And I would have to guess that it would.
There's – if in the event that Biden does not remain in the presidential race, absolutely, the Vice President Harris would be the person who Democrats are going to line up behind for the presidential candidate. You know, as much talk as people like to say that, you know, open it up, the movement behind a Kamala Harris presidency in the event that Biden does not run, it's strong there. I mean, you have almost $100 million inside of a campaign coffer that, you know, that the Biden campaign and or any Democratic presidential campaign would want access to. Harris is the only person that has access to that money. Do I think if you have a Harris-Mark Kelly ticket, does that change the calculus of Arizona? I think absolutely it does. He's someone who's consistently been on the ballot. I think he can deliver for Arizona. But I think that there's an opportunity.
So, Marcus, you're shaking your head when Reginald was saying that if President Biden drops out, Kamala Harris will be the nominee. You think not?
There's absolutely no way Gavin Newsom will not throw a fit about her being
California governor.
Right. appointed, if you will, anointed would be a better word, to be the candidate. As far as the money goes, I mean, look, there's 100 different ways you can do this. Some of them end in a lawsuit that the RNC would probably put up to try and block the transfer of money. But the easiest road to go is just transfer that money over to the DNC. And then it's open for any candidate. But, you know, Gavin Newsom's clearly been working at this for a year and, you know, publicly running around telling everybody Joe Biden's my guy and I'll do anything humanly possible for him. But behind the scenes, we all know he's been running for president. And so I think he goes into conventions like, look, I got the California delegates locked down. I'll get a little help from my friends with the superdelegates and we're going to have a good old fashioned floor fight. And so far this morning, the public reports are that Biden will not make an endorsement of any Democratic candidate. He will stay out of the fight.
So, Reginald, both of you mentioned Senator Mark Kelly's name. His name has been floated both for the top of the ticket, also potential VP pick. What do you think the odds are that he is at least asked, let's say, if he would like one of those slots?
Yeah, I mean, I think his odds have greatly increased over the last couple of weeks. I mean, he's very popular. I mean,
he's an astronaut.
He's an astronaut, right? you know, he's very popular. He has a lot of strong relationships back in D.C. Obviously, we know he could fundraise like out of the world. I really think that he would be someone that could bring I think he'd sweep the floor with J.D. Vance in a vice presidential, you know, debate. I think he's someone who has strong relationships, and I think he'd be strong. He's also would be, you know, playing with free money. You know, with that being said, is that, you know, his race for U.S. Senate, you know, is not till 2028. So no matter what happens, he still would have a strong position in the Senate.
Do you think there's a chance that he is elevated somewhere?
I mean, let's see what the pollsters say. You know, here's what every pollster in the country is in the field right now trying to find out who the strongest candidate to run against Trump is.
Well, there have been some that have shown Mark Kelly doing pretty
absolutely.
Well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Among others.
You know, there is no testing that like a presidential campaign. I mean, you talk about under a microscope. So, you know, we'll have to see. Clearly, America has shown an affinity for astronauts. So, you know, that will be a little bit to play at it. But it also matters of who he's matched up with.
Right.
And with that, you know, when you talk about, you know, obviously what happened to, you know, former President Trump and the assassination attempt, I think, you know, if you talk about Mark Kelly, I mean, this is something that him and his family have lived through. I mean, you know, to be able to tell a story of the rhetoric in this country has gotten so high that you have people who are taking, you know, literal shots at elected officials. I mean, he understands that. He speaks to that. I think it provides an opportunity for him to talk to the country in a normal, sane way. And I think he's someone who could get something done as a VP candidate.
So let me ask you both very briefly about that assassination attempt on Saturday in Pennsylvania. In the wake of that, Marcus, and we saw this also in 2011 after the shooting of Gabby Giffords, a lot of talk about toning down the rhetoric, about civility in politics. Do you think there's any chance that lasts or it even happens in the first place?
I don't. I had great hopes immediately afterwards. I just don't think it's panning out very well. And it's going to take a lot more than one action. It's going to take a lot more than one president. You know, I don't know how that comes to fruition, but at some point, you know, the conversation needs to be had with all of America to tone it down a little bit.
What do you think, Reginald? Is it possible to tone down the rhetoric in this country at this point?
I think it's possible in the event that you have at the top of the ticket, the top of the parties, they actually they show leadership. And unfortunately, I don't think that leadership was shown during the RNC convention. I think the first few days of the convention was, you know, I thought it was ran very well. I thought, you know, the tone was, you know, we're going to be here for everyone. We wanted unity in this country. And then the further you watch the convention, you started to see it creep back up.
All right. So let's move on to some statewide politics here. Marcus, I want to ask you about the ruling late last week that a state judge made to keep the legislative Republicans' border security measure on the ballot. The state Supreme Court is going to take it up. Were you surprised that the judge ruled that it did not violate the single subject rule?
Honestly, I was. I was really caught off guard by that, and largely because at least on its face to me, it looked like it was a violation of the single subject. You're talking about fentanyl and how you're charged when you're trafficking in fentanyl, and at the same time talking about an immigration enforcement mechanism at the border, which on its face to me seemed like two separate subjects. But the judge obviously disagrees, and he's well, he's more qualified than I am. He
went to law school,
right? But I would think I'm just 10 times more interested in what the state Supreme Court, what their decision is on this measure.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question now, right? Like, does the state Supreme Court keep this on the ballot or not? And it seems as though, like, this might be the kind of case that has ramifications beyond just this case, because we're dealing with, you know, with something that a lot of measures, a lot of laws run into in terms of the single subject rule.
I mean, if you look at the single subject rule and you look at this, you know, this measure, it's clear. I mean, for most folks who are reading it, it seems pretty clear. You know, will it still remain on a ballot? I'm going to say, you know, I think it will. I mean, when you look at the courts here, you know, there's a history of, things that look plain as day, that you think, you know, the court would go one way and they decide to go a complete opposite way. And I think that's where people really start to believe that there's a lot of, politics happening in the judiciary.
So assuming that you're right, Reginald, and it does stay on the ballot, what does that do for turnout and potential results come November?
I don't know who's going to be spending a ton of money on this ballot measure itself. I think the top of the ticket candidates, they're going to be talking about immigration. Mm-hmm. Immigration is going to be a topic. So I don't know if there's going to be a concerted effort to put a ton of money behind this issue alone. But, you know, it's going to be a long ballot. We're talking, you know, 3-4 pages. So if folks make its way down there and they decide, I think it could pass. It could pass. I think there'll be folks fighting against it, but it's going to be a major issue.
Marcus, who do you think has the bigger campaign between now and November, the pro side or the anti side?
Oh, the anti side will probably have the more money, but it'll be irrelevant. I mean, this thing's going to pass. And I think we've undervalued how frustrated Arizonans are with illegal immigration. The irony, of course, here is, you know, this measure was intended to be a turnout motivator for Republicans, right? And that was on the heels of the abortion decision. And now the ballot proposition having to do with abortion was, of course, a motivator for Democrats to turn out to the ballot. And so the Republicans countered with, okay, let's go with illegal immigration and that'll help move Republicans to the ballot. And I would argue that although that was all totally true at the time, the world has changed so significantly in such a short amount of time that actually neither of the measures will probably be the motivating factor to get to the ballot anymore, especially if Biden decides he's not running and they have a new candidate, that's going to be new energy involved around that candidate and that campaign that'll be a motivator in itself.
I'm curious about the idea to sort of bring it back nationally as we're starting to wrap up. Reginald, do you think that, like, is there something to be said? You know, Marcus mentions an enthusiasm gap between Trump supporters and Biden supporters. If there is a new candidate, maybe an open convention, does that do something for energy on the Democratic side?
I think you're going to see a lot of energy, particularly around abortion. I mean, you know, abortion is still a significant issue. With the selection of J.D. Vance and his push for a national abortion ban, I think if you're going to see any type of energy, you're going to see that abortion initiative get even more money than it already has, more folks talking about that issue and really defining the Trump-Vance ticket as one that's going to not be good for women and families here in Arizona.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Reginald Boulding, Marcus Dellartino, guys, thanks for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what happens when an escape room takes the definition of escape to the extreme? But first, Phoenix will host the WNBA All-Star Game tomorrow evening at Footprint Center downtown. Before that, there will be a three-point shooting contest and skills competition tonight, as well as WNBA Live, a fan experience at the Phoenix Convention Center. All of this comes as the league is enjoying increased attendance and TV ratings. The All-Star Game itself is sold out, and tickets in the resale market are selling for more than $100, up to a couple thousand dollars for front row seats. With me to talk about the game and the league at the halfway point in the season is Cassandra Negley, women's basketball writer for Yahoo Sports. And Cassandra, there are a bunch of teams in playoff contention. Interest in the league is up. How would you describe where the WNBA is right now?
Yeah, it's been an interesting season so far. You have the Liberty at the top, which isn't that surprising. That's a team that has all five of their starters back, has that chemistry for a second year, was built to contend for a title. You have the Sun towards the top, which maybe is a little bit surprising, but we've seen them have success. Can this be the year? Obviously, Minnesota wins the Commissioner's Cup championship, which again is a little bit of a surprise. And we saw the Aces fall down the standings, which another super surprise. This is supposed to be the potential three-time champion. Attendance is up around the league. Viewership is up around the league. I think just anecdotally, there's more people talking about the league, talking about Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark and all the players they're being introduced to. I think it's been one of the more fun seasons in recent years.
What is the buzz around this year's All-Star Game, I mean, both within the league and maybe just sort of, you know, among fans and, you know, folks who are you know, interested in this league?
I think within the league, the buzz is excitement because we're going to see Team USA versus Team WNBA. And the last time we saw this, Team WNBA won. This is an All-Star Game that's actually going to feature defense, that's actually going to feature maybe just some more tactics as Team USA gets ready for the Olympics. So it's not your average everyday All-Star game. For fans, I think there is one thing and one main thing that they're looking forward to, and it is Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark teaming up on Team WNBA.
It seems like particularly good luck for the city of Phoenix that this is the year that the All-Star game is here. I mean, attendance is up, viewership is up. There's a lot more attention on the WNBA maybe than there has been in years past.
Yeah, the All-Star game, I think in the past few years has sold really, really well. The WNBA has done a good job, and I'm already seeing this in Phoenix, of really making it a fun few-day event for fans with things like WNBA Live, with activations around the city. I also think it's really cool that it's in Phoenix because we're seeing Diana Taurasi go on to the Olympics, potentially one of her last All-Star games. We say this all the time. They're opening a practice facility, naming courts after her. I really like that Phoenix has leaned into the history of the franchise and the history of the league because I think that's more important now than ever, and we don't see that a lot.
I mean, you mentioned Diana Taurasi, of course, Brittany Griner here as well, going off to the Olympics. I mean, could this potentially be a boost for the Mercury for the rest of the season, who are, you know, sort of looking to make the playoffs?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I was talking to Sophie Cunningham a couple days ago about the break and what players who aren't on the Olympic team are planning on doing. She said, first and foremost, because it's Sophie, they're excited to go on vacation and take some time away. But they'll come back and practice together and bond together while the Olympians are away. She actually mentioned the 2021 year where Phoenix went on a run out of the break and they made it all the way to the finals as a number 5 or 6 seed. So we're going to see, I think, coming out of this, a lot of turning of the standings of the table. Some teams that maybe don't have a lot of Olympians, or a team like the Mercury that know how to do this, really succeed out of the break.
Yeah, so there's about a month or so break after the All-Star game with the Olympics before everybody comes back and the WNBA regular season continues. What are you going to be looking for the rest of the regular season?
I'm going to be looking for which team has the most momentum and continues to get better and better and better. It's great that the Liberty are sitting where they are right now, but they can't lose control of that. A team like Minnesota, can they get back that magic that took them to the Commissioner's Cup title? And then teams like Angel Reese's Chicago and Caitlin Clark's Indiana, can they use this time as an extended training camp to really come together as a team and maybe surprise a few more teams at the top of the table and get in a good position for the playoffs?
Let me ask you, we've talked a little bit about how attendance and viewership is up. There's some news this week about the potential for a new media rights deal, a TV deal with the WNBA, which would be a pretty significant increase over what it has been. Although there are some in the league, including the head of the WNBA Players Union, who say it's still undervalued. The NBA is not giving the WNBA its due. What is the conversation like sort of within the WNBA at this point about what that deal could mean and whether or not it's the right one?
It's still really early, but the big thing is the number. As you said, this is, I think, like 4 times what previous media packages have been, and that's huge. We could see salaries go up. We could see more investment from owners. We're already seeing charter flights starting for the next couple of years, and probably that will continue. But I think much like we saw with the NCAA tournament on the women's side, is it being undervalued? Because we've seen viewership go up over the past few years, obviously taken a big hike this year. That's only going to continue to grow. And I believe the reported length of that media deal is 11 years. Mm-hmm. That's a really long time for a growing league. So there is some trepidation from players and fans, and I think even some people around the league, that they're selling themselves short right now.
Are you hearing anything yet? You mentioned it's still very early, but are you hearing anything yet about an attempt on the part of anyone within the WNBA to maybe renegotiate that or try to get a little bit more out of the NBA's deal?
I haven't heard anything. There's reporting that in a couple of years they could opt to renegotiate that deal based on viewership. Kathy Engelbert has said for a long time now that they will try and make their own media deal where it makes sense versus working with the NBA. But the NBA still has some ownership of the WNBA. And I think at a certain point, the WNBA's hands are kind of tied in what exactly they can do.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Cassandra Negley. She covers women's basketball for Yahoo Sports. Cassandra, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Therapy dogs can help people with Alzheimer's, anxiety, PTSD, or depression. But one organization gives these dogs a different task, improving kids' reading skills. The show's Amber Victoria Singer went to Peoria Main Library recently to learn more about Pause to Read, an organization that partners with libraries around the valley to connect kids and therapy dogs.
Eleanor wandered slowly outside into the garden. She went and sat on the lawn for a while, enjoying the warm smell of newly cut grass.
It's Saturday afternoon in the children's book corner at Peoria Main Library. A corgi and a chocolate lab are lounging on the floor with their handlers, listening to kids practice reading out loud to them.
My name is Kendall, and I am 7 years old. I like to read to the dogs so I can read, and I can pet some dogs and have fun.
That's Kendall Huff. She and her older sister Adeline have been coming to Pause to Read almost every month since the beginning of the year with their mom, Jane Huff.
It gives the girls a reason to read out loud to someone else that's not myself, that won't judge them because they won't necessarily see them again, and it builds that reading fluency skill.
Huff's daughters have different reasons for enjoying Pause to Read.
My oldest, Adeline, she gets really excited for these types of events because she has a lot of anxiety, and this is a smaller way for her to read out loud to people without a lot of eyes on her. It's a small group. There's no judgment. And then Kendall, my youngest, really enjoys acting out her stories, and it gives her a way to be more flamboyant.
Suddenly a sparkling rainbow mist filled the entire clearing, and Eleanor saw rainbow droplets forming and twinkling on her skin.
Adeline is reading to Penny, the chocolate lab. Sarah Roddy is a high school special education teacher and Penny's owner. She's sitting nearby, encouraging Penny to listen.
I always send my students' parents a message when we go on summer break telling the kids to continue to practice their reading. Their reading level goes down if you don't practice reading for the entire summer.
I want to know how Penny feels about all this. Do you like getting stories read to you, Penny?
No, I just think it's a great opportunity for the kids. I even have had teenagers come sit here and read to Penny. So it's not just the little kids. Anytime anybody practices reading is great.
July's Pause to Read event at Peoria Main Library is this Saturday from 1 to 2:30 p.m. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Amber Victoria Singer.
It is the show. I'm joined now in studio by our own Sam Digman. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. Mark, tell me if you think this is an understatement, but there's a lot going on in the news, would you say?
Yeah, that is maybe the understatement of the decade.
I would not blame many of our listeners if they are craving some escapism right about now. And I recently met some Valley residents who specialize in providing just that.
Okay, I definitely don't know how to get in.
It's a Wednesday afternoon, and I'm walking around Desert Ridge looking for the entrance to a place called the Nemesis Club. I've been given an address, but it leads me to an ice cream shop called the Soda Jerk. I walk into the Soda Jerk, and I find happy families enjoying sundaes and root beer floats. I approach the counter, where one of the employees is standing in front of a large refrigerator door.
Hello.
How's it going?
I'm looking for the entrance to the Nemesis Club.
You found it.
I did.
You did. Okay. Yeah.
Cleverly disguised as a refrigerator door.
That's right.
She opens the refrigerator door and leads me into a series of dark wood-paneled hallways lit by low lamplight. Finally, we arrive in the lobby of the Nemesis Club, where a small group is waiting for us.
Three of our eight players, so we've got a little bit of time.
Okay, hello, three of the eight players. I'm Sam. Thank you guys so much for doing this.
Of course.
This is in the name of journalism. The task we're about to undertake, in the name of journalism, is an escape room, one of three operated by the Nemesis Club. The one we're about to do is called Mogollon Monster, and it's one of the top 100 escape rooms in the entire world, according to Terpica.
Terpica stands for the Top Escape Rooms Project Enthusiast Choice Awards.
That's Rich Bragg, the founder of Terpica. If anyone has played enough escape rooms to qualify as an escape room enthusiast, it's Rich.
I'm at about 1,300 overall now.
Some escape rooms, Rich says, are just a set of walls, a handful of themed puzzles, and a timer. But the best rooms, the ones that appear on Terpica's Top 100, those are much more immersive. They have full-blown sets, sound design, and actors playing characters. For Rich, these are the elements that put the escape in escape room.
I like to think of escape room as like escaping reality, not escaping the actual room. And so anything that really leans into that is something that really stands out to me.
Back at the Nemesis Club, I meet the players I'll be observing as they make their way through the room, the Ford family. It's a group of brothers and sisters who look to be in their late 20s or early 30s, along with their parents and some friends. The Fords may not quite be at Rich Bragg's level, but this isn't their first rodeo. How many escape rooms would you say you've played?
Oh gosh, what do you think?
Hi, I'm Victor. I'm one of the friends. We've done probably upward of 20 to 30 together, and then just on our own also. We're all, I think, very seasoned.
This will be my third one. Just this week.
Oh my God, you're on a streak.
We are on a streak. We're on an escape room streak.
With the group fully assembled, a Nemesis Club employee in a ranger uniform approaches us.
My name is Emma. I'm going to be your camp counselor today. We are heading up to the Mogollon Rim to a campsite built by the Monster Rangers. That's an organization that studies monsters.
Emma reaches towards what looks like a painting on the wall, but turns out to be another secret door.
Oh my God.
She opens it, and we file into a tent full of camping gear.
Scoot over.
All right, so rangers at this particular campsite study the Mogollon Monster. That's kind of like Arizona's Bigfoot, yeah?
Emma explains our task, which is to capture evidence of the Mogollon Monster on camera without making it angry.
I know it's a weird phenomenon, but the storm does tend to follow the monster as he walks through the woods. So if he's super close by, you might get like a left.
Everybody huddles in the dark as the sound of heavy footsteps and beastly grunts gets closer and closer. After a few moments, there's a clap of thunder and a burst of lightning, and a giant monster silhouette appears against the front of the tent. The shadow lumbers away, and Emma says, "We're on our own now." The tent opens, and the Fords make their way into the darkness.
And we need the lanterns. We need to take them.
Here you go, Mama.
Okay, I'll take a lantern.
When I asked Rich Bragg, the founder of Terpica, to describe some of his favorite escape room moments, he hesitated.
The ones that I'm thinking of right now are ones that if I told you, the owners would be really mad. So,
Rich's words are echoing in my mind as I watch the Fords start to explore the makeshift campground. I realize I'm standing in the middle of a mystery that the Nemesis Club has gone to great lengths to immerse me in. So while I can assure you that the Fords had a great time...
So there's like a little secret door and there's bacon, so I'm wondering if he will like...
There it is, got it.
Woo! Woo!
There
what
it is.
Was
it? Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4.
It just wouldn't feel right to give you any other details about what happens in there. Besides, the specifics of this particular escape room aren't the real mystery. For me, the bigger question is personified by Emma, the Nemesis Club employee who plays the role of the camp counselor. After we finish going through the room, Emma tells me that she just got back from vacation, and while she was gone, she used her free time to check out some other escape rooms.
I have to say, it's notable to me that you, you know, spend your work week in an escape room, and then in your free time... You go to escape, like
yeah.
When you're on vacation from the escape room,
lifestyle.
You go, say that again?
It's like a lifestyle, yeah.
So, if escape rooms are about escaping reality, what happens when escaping becomes reality? That, it turns out, is another situation that Rich Bragg has a lot of experience with.
So, I actually came from a community of puzzle games called The Game, which don't really exist anymore, but it was kind of an underground community. There was not a lot of, it wasn't really mainstream at all.
The Game, Rich explains, is a reference to a movie called Midnight Madness, which came out in 1980.
Five diametrically opposed teams of college students are challenged to compete in a grueling all-night game. Midnight Madness.
Midnight Madness tells the story of a grad student named Leon who designs this all-night puzzle game. The players are told to show up at a random location where they get a mysterious clue. If they can figure out what the clue means, it leads them to a new location where they get another clue.
The game will begin Friday at sunset and continue on through the night until one team is the first to arrive at a final location, the finish line.
So, at some point, someone decided to make a real-life version of the game from Midnight Madness, and that's The Game. Rich started playing it when he was a student at Stanford. I ask him how it worked, and he says one time he got a message that just said, show up at this train station.
And we were told to get on the train, and it's funny because we didn't actually know where the train was going until we were on it, and it took us like 100 miles away or something.
When the players got off the train, there were vans waiting for them, which took them to a field where each team was given a custom-built wand with LED lights and sensors.
It would sense the sort of swishes and flicks that you were doing, and if you had solved a puzzle and you'd then translated it into the wand language and you did all the right things, then the wand would know that you had solved that puzzle, and then the LEDs would light up and you could shake the wand and the LEDs would spell like what you had to do next. So
jaw is on the floor.
Yeah.
This rules.
It was amazing. Yeah.
The problem with the game is that playing it was a huge commitment. You had to block out an entire weekend for it, and you didn't know where it was going to take you.
It didn't scale well.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
Ever since escape rooms have become super popular, that whole subculture has just kind of died out.
Towards the end of my afternoon at the Nemesis Club, I meet Kylie and Dustin, the co-owners.
The last question I wanted to ask is, so when I was talking to Rich from Terpica, he brought up this thing called The Game.
I know The Game. Okay, but go ahead.
Oh, you know The Game.
Go ahead. We've never been invited to play The Game, but we've had brushes with The Game.
Really? What are the brushes?
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it. We had a couple groups come through, and by the way they were talking, we could tell that they were connected to The Game, and somehow our venue had been connected with The Game for some period of time. But honestly, I don't know a lot more than that.
Really?
Really? No, really. Do you?
So far, you're saying everything that I know about
it.
But I It's intriguing.
It is intriguing.
Okay.
So what happens when escape becomes reality? Maybe they both get more interesting. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman. And a special thanks to the Ford family, Danielle, Cameron, Bruce, Lori, and Tiffany, their friends Victor Garcia and Kaylee Woodson, and everybody at the Nemesis Club. And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, Gabriella Fernbaugh, and our reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, our news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Again, thank you for listening. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.